Our conversation with Mr. Brennan Jordan continue.
Hey, you want some coffee?
Let's turn to another topic. Weeks ago, I was talking to a lawyer, successful, prominent lawyer, who's a Negro, who said to me suddenly, I find myself spending a lot of energy on inverting symbolisms in the society around me. When I find anything is white or bright, equaling value, I'm turning this around and denying it into myself. Living in a white culture where the symbolic values of white and bright and light are equal good, valuable, and dark and black, these things equal the opposites. I find myself defensively turning these around to in my own mind, always hidden symbolisms. How do you respond to that?
His
condition. How do you feel about his condition?
Well, I think that this is a problem that many Negroes are having. Rejection of. And I guess what he means to some extent is a white man's standard.
White equaling good is symbol.
Yeah. For me, I don't have that problem because...
White is white rose.
Yeah, sure. And I think it requires some sort of decision-making on the part of the individual Negro concerned. And I think it's a part of a value system that he sets up himself, despite whatever valuation is placed by the use of that particular symbol or what it means in the white community. For me, it's a matter of individual choice. And I don't attach any significance to a particular thing because it's characteristically white or characteristically Negro. If it can serve my self-interest or the self-interest of my wife and daughter.
You don't find the symbolisms of the blaze of light equaling truth offensive. You don't find the white robes of God offensive. These matters of white and value somehow being equated in a whole symbolism in the society in which you live.
Well, it doesn't bother me.
It doesn't bother you.
No.
It does some people to the point almost of physical distress.
I think it does. It doesn't bother me because I feel secure enough to feel I can determine my own values in terms of not what they mean to my peers or to my neighbors, but what they mean to me and those persons whom I must necessarily immediately relate, my wife, my daughter, my mother, my father, or my in-laws.
Or your white friends.
That's right. If these values have meaning for me, and there might be even some conflict here with my wife.
You wipe out the symbolic structures around you entirely and say what they mean to me in literal terms.
That's right. For me. Now, I think that there are some people who are not so disposed. And I think that many Negroes have problems with this. I've been exposed to the white culture at its level best as a result of my college days.
Sure. You read Shakespeare, so that's full of it.
That's right.
And the Bible, the King James Version is full of it.
But I did not take on these things as being sacrosanct because they were white. I compared the two cultures, or compared the two systems of values necessarily, and arrived at my own.
As you went behind the symbolisms to your personal realities.
That's right, and evaluated them on the basis of that which is most advantageous and that which mostly pleases me. And this to me is the most important thing. If I'm pleased and happy, then to hell with what John Doe thinks.
The fact that truth is given as a white robe, a blaze of light, doesn't strike you as anything else.
Well, it's not going to be repulsive to me. But this is to say also that it doesn't mean I'm going to like it or love it. It depends upon how, in a given set of circumstances, what in a given set of circumstances this means to me. Maybe that's talking in circles.
No, it's not. I think it's not talking in circles at all. In this connection, there are some. I don't want to talk as an anthropologist, by the way, but you have some strange facts. The same symbolisms of white equaling true or good, and dark equaling,
bad
and
dirty,
and bad, are African symbolisms too. It's a strange anthropological fact. There are some dances. I won't go into all of this. Some dances where you have a struggle between virtue and vice. These are native dances, traditional dances. Virtue is the white plumed headdress, white robe. There's no makeup, you see. Both the faces
sure.
are both, you see,
yeah.
of a natural, untinted faces. Yet the vice or evil is clothed in black. These are traditional tribal dances going back before European contact.
Well,
Chinese the same way.
Yeah.
Although they paint the face white for this traditional dance.
Yeah, maybe this follows through in our own culture. We drape things in black with death, but we marry in white as a sense of purity. But I don't associate the lady in the wedding gown in white with any value of the white man.
Now, what I'm getting, you don't, but some do.
Sure.
What I'm getting at is this. We have a strange situation where a racial contrast between Negro and white man in America has led to a whole tangle of symbolism. Which is no problem for the African, no problem for the Chinese, no problem with the Malay. There's enough traditional stuff, as far as I read, carried over, where the like day and night are carried without reference to the two complexions. Yet this has suddenly become a real issue for many American Negroes.
Well,
it's always been neurotic about it.
I think one manifestation of that is that. The old blue blood or blue vein notions that used to exist in the Negro community, that the light-skinned Negroes were better than the dark-skinned Negroes. I think that this is a manifestation to some extent of what you're talking about. But to me, this is tommy rot. I guess the indication is if you are light, and certainly this is biologically true, that somewhere or other there's some white blood or white ancestry here. But this to me means nothing. The only significance that I would attach to it is that there is some white blood somewhere, some white ancestry. And what does this determine for me? It determines nothing except that there's some white ancestry somewhere.
Yeah. Let's make a statement here. A revolution aims at the liquidation of a regime or a class. There's always been somebody to be had heads chopped off, or literally or figuratively. At least in the liquidation of the power of that regime. It does not have to concern itself with a mutual a way of life, a modus vivendi, after victory. The revolution looks forward to a crucial confrontation. Will you kill the Tsar, you know, or chop the head of the aristocrat, whatever the revolution is you're doing, or drive the British out. But the Negro movement must look forward to a settlement, not a liquidation. Therefore, there must be new techniques and new objectives for this if it is a revolution. Is this making any sense?
Let me say this. As I see the revolution, the revolution is a revolution fought, number one, not to take over, but it is a revolution.
That's one difference.
Yeah.
No liquidation, in other words.
That's right. That's right. But it's a revolution wherein you assume or that you take unto yourself not anything superior, not anything less than what is already given, but you assume some equal stature or equal recognition or equal opportunity or equal chance. This is not to say that you're going to hog the show, but this is to say that if two apples are being passed out, that you're going to get your two apples right alongside the next fella. And that because you are Negro, that you necessarily are limited to a half apple. And I think that this is what the revolution is about, is that a half a loaf or 99... 100% is not enough, that you got to have all of it in terms of your equal share, in terms of your share, and what goes on in the opportunities and then the privileges that, and also with this, the rights and privileges, that you also share in the responsibilities.
One more thing here now. This does not conform to any previous social movement, as far as I can make out. It's not, has no parallel in anything in history. I'm inclined to believe. I don't want to be dogmatic about that. This is new. Now, you may say, therefore, it's not a revolution. That is the word. As I follow you around, this is not at all like any revolutionary event that's ever occurred before.
Yeah,
it does not aim for liquidation of a class or a group of people. Only for a change of idea. Is that right?
And a change of idea, and a change of status from one of number two to an equal place, and moving into this, you do not usurp anything that the people who already have these rights have.
In other words, this might be said to be the first democratic revolution in the world.
I'm not sure that I'm in a position to substantiate the,
I can't
that prove contention.
It out among
But I do think that the most important thing about this revolution is that it is not a revolution geared to liquidate, as you used. And it's not a revolution that builds street barricades. It's not a revolution that's fought with arms. But it's a revolution, I think, that operates on a very human level, whereby you try to get people to do things on the basis that people are people.
Well, going back then, this would seem to be the first democratic revolution has ever existed. Now, this definition, where it's not aiming to liquidate a class or regime, but meant to reinterpret the life of a whole society.
That's right. There, overthrow is a good word. There's some people in the South who said they're trying to overthrow us. But I think that this thing is a matter of presently the white man being in the driver's seat and saying gee and haw, pulling both reins. But here's a Negro who's saying, let me too get up here in the driver's seat and let me have something to say about which way this horse is going gee or which way he's going haw.
That is the white man you are talking about misinterprets the whole movement. Is that right?
That's right.
He doesn't understand the nature of it.
I think this is part of true specialness. And he doesn't understand that when a Negro gains this right of first-class citizenship, he doesn't understand that when a Negro gains this, that he does not lose anything.
Right. There's that part. Right.
Yeah.
He doesn't lose anything.
Because you can't lose that which you, in a sense, don't have a right to exclusively.
That is, he does not conceive of the nature of this revolution. He thinks it's the same as the previous revolution, if we call it a revolution, whatever we call it.
Yeah, this revolution is not a coup.
It's not a power grab, put it that way.
That's right.
Now, undoubtedly, I think we must admit this, for some Negroes it is.
But I think that even those Negroes. But this is a myth, it seems to me.
Those people are outside the actual social process.
Yes.
But some it is, clearly. Everybody has vengeances to liquidate.
Yeah. And there is some vindictiveness involved in this, but I think that.
Vindictiveness, you're saying. Some people would say, in anatomizing revolutions of the past, they would say there are two dynamic forces in a revolution, hope and hate. You can't have a revolution until you have the hope for change and some guarantee of success. The purely beaten down can only have a servile revolt that leads nowhere. But revolution means a dynamic hope for a change, envisageable, plus a hate. Now here,
I think you have to address yourself to hate of what, and I think it.
Go ahead.
I think it has to be a hate of what, whether it's a hate of the system, or whether it's a hate of the people who perpetuate the system.
All right, now we have a distinction which has never been made before in any revolution. It's the first time. All the force has been of the perpetuators, not of the thing perpetuated.
Yes, and I think that this revolution, if you're going to use the word hate here must be used as hating the not the perpetuators, but that which is perpetuated, the system itself. Because I think to hate those people in power or those people who perpetuate would lead to the overthrow or the liquidation necessary.
Well, you are now talking like Dr. King.
Well, I don't mind talking like Dr. King.
I'm not saying that as an affront to you at all. I'm just saying you are.
Yeah. But now, of course, I think you also ought to understand that personally, I'm not out to redeem the soul of America either.
Well, would you do it just in passing, perhaps, with your left hand?
Well, I think that, you see, I take the position that when I exercise my constitutional right, I don't care how the man sitting at the neck table next to me feels about it. or whether my presence that changes his heart or not. I don't give a damn if he regurgitates, or if he gets up and leaves, or if he turns over his glass or spills his coffee on the waitress. That's his problem.
Wouldn't you have a slight preference to that matter?
Well, there's nothing like eating your meal sort of in some quietude, in some tranquil situation. But by the same token, if this man is uneasy, if he gets ants in his pants, that's his problem. And it only becomes my problem at such time that he comes and stands over me or disturbs me in the peaceful or tranquil enjoyment of my meal. Now, by that I mean, my presence there is not geared to redeem him. It's not geared to redeem him, to love me, to think well of me. But I also feel that if I sit next to him in the classroom long enough, or that if I sit next to him on an airplane long enough, that somewhere along the way, he's going to come to the same realization that my classmates came to who had to live with me without their consent. That this guy, he's just another guy. That he has, basically he does many of the same things that we do, but he doesn't like asparagus and I don't like Brussels sprout.
Well, how different are you from Dr. King, then?
Well, I think that Dr. King's philosophy is such that through this creative suffering, I think he calls it, that you reach out and you make this man love you. It you cultivate. Because I've never been quite sure what he means about love, because when he talks about this love, he says that I can assure you that you can't like everybody. Well, I agree with him on that. A lot of folks, white and black, I don't like. A lot of folks, white and black, I don't want to live next door to. A lot of folks, white and black, I don't want in my house for dinner or collecting my bills or for anything else. And so I don't have no problem with that. But this business of redeeming the soul, and I guess this is through some sort of spiritual revelation as to the goodness and to the some sort of perfect situation where the Negro is concerned. I'm not interested in that. When I send my child to school, or when I go to school, or when I use a public conveyance, or when I pay my taxes, I just don't want anybody to disturb me in the free exercise of my constitutional rights. Now, how he feels as he sees me exercising his rights is his problem.
Tell me this. Suppose we had all matters of constitutional rights clearly defined and clearly settled, so there's no friction at all at that level. Civil rights, constitutional rights. What remains?
Well, I think if you had this saying clear,
all clear set,
and you had the behavior of folk as a result of this clarity, controlled
by what?
By the law itself, by the operation of the law, to say that when this man comes to register to vote, that you cannot impose upon him arbitrary standards because he's black. That when you get these kind of things dissipated, that somehow or other, as this Negro operates freely in this situation, that even the most prejudiced white man will come to see, as he sees him operating freely. This has been his problem. He's always seen him operate under a given set of circumstances and can only appreciate him for him acting under this given set of circumstances, dictated by custom, mores, and usage. But when he sees him acting as a free agent, and at that time he will come to, I believe, ultimately, some appreciation of this person, not as a black man, but as an individual.
That is, you're putting your faith then in a legal framework which allows the human free play after that.
That's right. That's right. And once you get this free play, once you get this intercourse, once you find that when you sit next to this man that he reads the newspaper, that he's tired on the bus going home, that he's anxious to get home to his wife and a warm bowl of stew just like you are, that you find his similarities. You find his similarity of hope, to some extent, similarity of despair. And these are common bonds.
It's the human communion you put your trust in.
That's right.
Once the legal framework is settled.
That's right. But now, until such time that the bus driver knows that it's illegal for him to crack me across my head, or that he does not have the sanction of the state to hit me across my head because I sit on the front seat, then we can never reach this point of human communion, because he always sees me in a servile or a different situation. He just sees me. He cannot see me as I really am. But he sees me in a condition imposed upon me by explicit circumstances.
What happened in Germany, and I don't know the answer to this.
I hope you don't expect me to tell you.
In the late 20s, about the Jews.
Yeah.
Who had total legal protection and apparently full participation in a society or all practical standards.
Well, I think that you have to look at the leadership there, a man who's going to take these certain group of people and exploit them because of their religious difference.
That was a small matter, though, wasn't it? Something else was involved. Religion was just something.
Well, he had
difference.
Yes,
the word, not
yes.
Religious difference.
Yes. That here were some people different, and if I attack them on the basis of that difference, then I can ride the crest of power.
Let me ask you a question, shifting around a little bit. When James Baldwin writes that the Southern mob, there's a street gang, you know, for the cops in Jackson, act as they act, they do not represent the will of the Southern majority. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense in that I believe the vast majority of Southerners, white Southerners, for some reason or other, would be reluctant to be identified with his lunatic friends. And I also believe this, that you got on one extreme, maybe 20% of the people who are totally opposed to it. On the other side, this other
20%,
opposed to the mob and the tactics of the mob, this kind of thing. And who also believe in the complete equality and freedom of the Negro. And then you have the other 20% that composes the mob. But then you have a 60% who will go pretty much the way that the populace goes, that so long as it does not involve them having to make a personal witness, a testimony. And this is why I think leadership is so very important.
There's no leadership in the South now except for the segregationists. Yes, sir. No real leadership.
Well,
there's some little spotty, but there's no fundamental leadership, is there?
Because I think that the real fundamental leadership is silent. And the people
it doesn't lead that. It's
that's silent. Right. That's right. That's right. And their silence makes them ineffective. And once you can give once a guy like Chuck Morgan in Birmingham vocalizes, and this takes an awful lot of courage, and it ultimately resulted in Chuck's having to leave Birmingham. And it takes a great deal of courage, because what the man is faced with, or what he thinks he's faced with, is a very bread and butter matter. He's a lawyer who must necessarily depend upon white clients for business, and this business depends upon his house mortgage or his house mortgage and the grocery bill depend upon the business. Then he's got considerations. And maybe if you can dispel these fears, you can get more people to act.
One historian said to me some time back, fear is the curse of the South, but it's the fear of the white man for the white man.
How do you want me to respond?
Whatever you said, well, respond.
Well, I think that the white man is afraid, not only of his white brother, but of himself. He's not sure how he's going to act in a given set of circumstances. And then the laws, the customs, and the usage of the community make him feel compelled to act in a certain vein. Because, as Reisman says, we all like to belong. And nobody wants the... everybody wants the pleasure of his brothers and of his peers.
You just said a big thing there, and let's stop at that point. He's not afraid of his neighbor, but he's afraid of himself.
Well, I think this is...
I think it's right. It's a big thing.
Sure.